equipment does the brass want us to carry? Well, we don't really know what we'll encounter, he said thoughtfully, so I think we should go with a mix. I'll have Harris carry heavier generators with his squad, along with longer-range weapons and shielding. In contrast, your group will run light. No extra armament, but extra cells instead for endurance and plenty of speed. I frowned, but nodded. It was his call. Personally, I didn't think we should take the longer-range weaponry at all. So far on this planet, I hadn't been able to see farther than 100 meters past my nose. There was too much swirling mist. If we did run into a fight, it was going to be like having a battle in a blizzard. I didn't much like the idea of moving faster and rushing around blindly either, but Leeson was in charge. We loaded up, and I rode out on point. Graves had organized his 3 platoons, with 2 of them split light-heavy like mine, but 3rd platoon was all heavy. That amounted to 4 squads of slower machines in the center and 2 faster squads flanking. The other units were farther off to either side of us. They were going to take separate, parallel paths. On our screens inside the cockpit, it was pretty easy to keep track of where everyone was. I knew that if those screens and sensors ever failed, however, we'd be lost very quickly. Our GPS systems weren't working due to the strange atmospherics and the heavy metallic composition of the planet. We had compasses and scratchy radio, neither of which was 100% reliable, and that was it. The journey up north to the methane lake took hours, and it was a strange experience. Our light dragons could run at about 50 kilometers an hour, double that for short bursts. They could spring over obstacles, climb steep hills, and even ford streams. But when traveling at high speeds, we were running blind. The mist and precipitation caked up on our visors and external camera pickups. Even under the best of conditions, we couldn't see far into the soupy air. We reached the lake and turned east. After about an hour of running along the lake shore, we ran into our first serious obstacle. I pulled up short and called it in. Leeson, this is 1st Squad. We've hit a big river, sir.
How big?
I don't know. I can't see the far side.
He cursed for a few seconds, then relayed my unwelcome news up the chain of command. When he finally got back to me, he had new orders.
We'll be up to you pretty soon. 2nd platoon just reported in further south. Same thing. We want you to scout the river for depth, McGill. Don't let that methane get up past your legs to the core of your chassis.
Right, sir.
I wheeled my dragon to face the others who had gathered up and were letting their cells recharge off their fusion generators while they waited for new orders.
We're going to find out just how deep this river is, I announced.
Oh, really? Asked Carlos. Let me guess. It's my turn to die already, is it?
It would be, but I need your dragon, I told him. Anyone feel like going for a swim?
Dragons roamed along the shoreline looking at the silvery surface of rippling methane. No one said anything. This must be why Harris had never asked for volunteers, I realized.
Gorman, Rourke, you're on,
I ordered. They groaned and cursed, but wandered down to the edge of the flowing liquid. They both put in that first metal foot like they could feel the cold. I goaded my machine up behind them.
Spread out, I boomed. I don't want you both going into the same hole. Keevy, Carlos, attach a tow cable to each of these brave souls.
With a steel cable taut on each machine, we watched them step out into the moving liquid.
Ever seen a methane-drinking shark before?
Carlos called out to Gorman, who he had on his tether.
I hear they like shiny objects.
Shut up, Ortiz,
I heard myself saying. I had to admit, each day I spent as a veteran made me feel more sympathy for Harris. Could it be that this job shaped the man as much as the other way around? I didn't get any more time for introspection, unfortunately. Rourke ran into trouble about 10 meters out. His dragon went down on one leg, even though the river hadn't looked to be that deep. One minute he'd been in about 1 meter of water, and the next he was floundering.
"What's got you, Rourke?"
I demanded.
"Not sure, vet. 1 foot must have stepped into a deep hole."
"Shark! Shark!"
shouted Carlos unhelpfully.
"Keevy, haul on that cable," I said. "Take the slack out of it."
She did as I asked, backing her mount up the bank. She pulled, but Rourke's dragon wasn't budging. Inside my dragon, I clenched my teeth. This wasn't the sort of problem I could afford to kick up the chain of command. I should be able to handle it myself. Gorman had retreated out of the river and joined the group looking out toward Rourke with concern. Instead of ordering Gorman back into harm's way, I marched out into the river after Rourke myself.
"Careful, vet,"
Gorman said, eyeing my rescue attempt.
"I got a feeling there might be more holes out here."
I moved warily. It wasn't an easy thing to do. The machine didn't have sensors in the bottom of its feet. I had to feel my way like a man driving a car over uneven ground, hoping he didn't get stuck. As a precaution, I had my tow line hooked up to my troops on the shoreline. When at last I made it to Rourke, I managed to use my arm segments to latch onto him. Bending my legs into a crouch, then standing erect, I hauled him straight up. There was resistance, that much I was sure of. Whatever he'd found, it wasn't just a simple hole, there was something trying to keep him down. When we were both mobile again, I noticed that Rourke still had trouble. His dragon tottered to the shore. I accompanied him in case he went down again, figuring his leg actuator might have gone bad.
"What is that thing?"
Keevy asked. I stopped and rotated my chassis to get a good look. Keevy was right. There was something attached to Rourke's machine. It was like a cylinder wrapped around the lower leg section, and there was a glowing amber light on top of it, too.
"What the... could that be a mine?"
Keevy asked.
"Back up! He's gonna blow!"
Carlos shouted. The group scattered like hens. I stood there with Rourke, who was trying to escape his fate. He had his grippers on the top of the cylinder pushing down. I reached out, seeing a group of wires on top. They were crude, thick wires. I snipped them with my grippers and the amber light died. Using my dragon's powerful arms, I ripped the thing loose and dropped it on the rocks with a clang.
"Well," I said, "if that was mine, it was a pretty piss-poor one."
The squad wandered back to us, looking paranoid. I decided it was time to report in.
"Adjunct Leeson, sir, the river has a problem. There seems to be devices in it, buried in the water. I don't know their function or who put them there, but they seem to be traps. They might disable anyone who tries to cross."
"Roger that, McGill. We've had other reports of a similar nature, like that battery you found yesterday, lots of discarded hardware. Command is suspecting that this planet was once inhabited, or maybe still is, by a technologically savvy species."
Who could it be? I thought of the squids right off, but it just didn't seem to be their style. This whole planet wouldn't have been appealing to them for colonization, just for resources. Who else might be living down here on this cold, mist-covered rock? We were ordered to abandon our attempts to ford the river. It was too deep, too treacherous, and too wide. Instead, we angled south, off course, and ran along the shoreline. Behind us, the main mass of troops arrived. I left the artifact we'd found on the beach for them to examine. About a half hour's run southward, we ran into something new. There was a cluster of low metal domes near the river. Don't get me wrong, the domes didn't have the fresh, forged look of our ships and machines. Instead, they were dirty and corroded. Everything about the place looked unfinished and crude. The domes were close to the methane, arranged in a semicircle. We didn't march into the middle of them, as we were wary by now.
"What the hell is this?"
Carlos asked.
"Some kind of fishing village?"
When he said that, it struck me that he was right. That was exactly what it looked like, a fishing village.
"Carlos, check that hut up there on the hill."
"Shit,"
he said, then trotted his machine to the structure I'd indicated. There was a door of sorts, consisting of two heavy metal plates piled over one another. He levered it open, and it clanged and clattered to the ground.
"I didn't say tear it up," I shouted after him. "If natives live here, you'll scare the living—"
That was as far as I got. A figure sprang up out of the door of the shack and scuttled away. Now, when I say figure, you have to understand I'm not talking about a humanoid. I'm talking about something that looked like a centipede built out of rusty garbage cans with churning metal struts for legs.
Holy crap! Carlos shouted. Did you see that guy? Did you see that?
Yeah, we sure did.
Carlos took after the thing. It wasn't small, but it was a lot smaller than he was. Lengthwise, it was probably 2 meters long and a half meter or so wide. Carlos caught up to it and launched himself up into the air, coming down on its back. He forced it down into the dirt where it squirmed and kicked.
Why is he killing it?
Kiwi demanded. Carlos, she's right. Don't harm it. That thing must be part of the native population. Carlos came back to us, holding the thing in his grippers. It squirmed and twisted, but couldn't get away. It didn't make any sound other than desperate, scrabbling noises.
If this is a native, this is one weird place, Carlos said. Listen, people, this is a machine.
We examined it, and we quickly realized he was right. The creature was all metal, with cameras for eyes and jointed struts for legs. It looked like it had been assembled out of spare parts. There had to be some level of AI inside the brain pan, however, as it was clearly pitiful and distressed.
We should take this back to Natasha, Carlos suggested. She'd get a kick out of dissecting it.
I think we should let it go, Kiwi said.
Something in her voice made me turn to look at her. She was staring back at us. I turned around and followed her gaze. There, looming out of the mist beyond the shacks, was a massive figure. It came up out of the methane river and moved like a rolling mass of interconnected plates. Shaped like a slug, it undulated to and fro as if uncertain. It seemed to be studying us. Carlos, put the caterpillar thing down, I ordered. Gently.
Oh, I want to keep him.
Do as I order or I'll fire on you.
Sheesh, all right. What's the... Oh.
He'd finally caught sight of the thing we were all staring at. He put the small machine down on the ground, and it scuttled off toward the bigger one. Chapter 14. We quickly retreated uphill away from the village along the river. The mountain of metal plates shifted around the domes and followed us, matching our pace. As a measured response, we moved slowly and gently away from the village, or nursery, or whatever the hell it was.
You think that's the mama, Kiwi?
I asked, whispering for some reason.
I bet it is. If that little one is hurt, I suggest we offer up Carlos as a sacrifice.
Hardly seems like a fair trade, I said. We don't want to piss off the locals further by giving them our most irritating trooper.
I didn't know, Carlos complained. How the hell was I supposed to know this world is inhabited by freaking machines? That's weird, man. Really weird. Who built them in the first place? How do they reproduce? What are they...
Could you shut up for 9 seconds, Ortiz?
I demanded.
I'm trying to report this in. Don't run anyone. It's like an animal. It's best to move slowly and confidently. Backward.
As we backed away from the village, the big machine eventually stopped following us and returned home. The bulk of it vanished into the white mists, and we were very happy to see the last of it.
Adjunct Leeson, I've got an unexpected contact to report.
I gave him the story, and he kicked me up to Graves before I finished the third sentence.
Have you got video?
Graves asked. Relaying and transmitting the file now, sir. Fortunately, Kiwi had had the presence of mind to flip on her suit recorders when we first met up with the village. The Centurion reviewed the file and let out a long breath.
We've been suspecting something like this. A dozen reports have hinted around, but you're the first to encounter an actual organized habitation. Good scouting, McGill.
Thanks. What are they, sir?
Native life, after a fashion. We've theorized about this, and the Galactics have hinted that some of the inhabitants of the core systems resemble these beings. They're electromechanical creatures. Robots, essentially.
Some of the Galactics are robots?
That's what we understand, Graves said. It's a miracle when you think about it, that the various species from the core worlds were able to cooperate long enough to build an empire at all.
I'm out in the field, sir. What should I do?
Be friendly with the locals. Get used to them. Maybe they'll get used to you. Machine life, McGill. Just think about them as flesh and blood. Wait a second. You didn't damage any of them, did you?
Not intentionally, sir.
What does that mean?
I explained about Carlos running one down and catching it, and Graves seemed tense.
You have to keep a tight rein on your people, McGill,
he said sternly.
We aren't marauders. Natives are key to any attempt we make to defeat the squids on this planet. We can't afford bad blood between us now.
I assured him I wouldn't harm any machines that didn't attack us directly.
Good, good, he said. We're working on this. Every tech we have on the surface is stretching their brains around it. Did you catch any transmissions?
Any what, sir?
Listen, machine life doesn't talk with a voice box. They send radio waves at one another. Did you record anything of that nature?
No, sir. We'll give it a shot if you want us to.
All right. I'm going to send a tech out there to your position to help with the investigation. Go back into the vicinity of the village and watch the aliens. Don't get too close, however. From the sounds of it, you encountered a mother machine and her brood. You can't threaten her young, do you understand?
Loud and clear, Centurion. He closed the channel, and I relayed his instructions to my nervous squad.
Go back there? Carlos demanded. Are you nuts? Did you see the size of that thing? It was made out of metal through and through. We couldn't stop it with these grenade launchers. It's as big as a building.
That's why we're going in slowly and staying well back. If it comes at us aggressively, we'll run. The mother machine, whatever it is, it didn't seem very fast.
Maybe that's because she hadn't charged us yet.
Despite Carlos's grumbling, we backtracked and came up over a rise to where we could see the village again. The moment our dragons showed their noses, the inhabitants clammed up. We had time to see a few of the small ones rushing to their little huts and slamming them closed. I figured they were probably already bleating for Mama. Any signals on your scanners?
I've got something down in the kilocycle range, Kivi said.
We tuned in and saw a spray of jagged waveforms. The machines were communicating, but I couldn't make heads or tails of it, and neither could our dragon's computers.
Let's back off, I said, and we retreated again.
Once we were out of sight, I dismounted from my machine and walked up to the ridge again. Specialist Sargon was heading up one of my two maniples. I put him in charge of the mounted troops with orders to rush to my rescue if I ran into trouble. I took Kivi with me as she was doing pretty well today in the absence of a real tech. I knew she'd been studying hard for that rank and saw this as her way to get a specialist's patch. There was no harm in giving her some field experience. I felt exposed out on the surface outside of my dragon. We got down low and crawled when we reached the top of the hill, on our bellies in the cold mud, hearing our respirators hiss in our helmets. We crept up on the village and looked down at it curiously. The village was alive again. Everybody had come out of their little clamshell huts to play. A half dozen machines frolicked about, crawling over the landscape with what seemed like random, energetic patterns.
"Are you getting this?"
I asked Kivi.
When I spoke, the machines halted and lifted up, looking around.
Kivi put her helmet close to mine, and I heard her muffled voice.
"Don't use radio. They can hear it."
"Roger that. Voice only."
After lifting up the front part of their bodies and briefly cranking their forms this way and that, the machines went back to whatever they were doing. They seemed to be excited. They had something inside one of the huts, something large and metallic. They hauled it out together, working like a swarm of ants.
"You know," I said,
"I bet those clamps buried in holes in the river were some kind of trap. They didn't blow up, so they aren't mines. Maybe these machines trap other machines."
"Everyone has to eat, I guess," Kivi agreed. "They must be running on methane for fuel, and they need metal to rebuild themselves and to grow larger. I've read about some forms of machine life in my studies. I think that the big one might smelt metal and have a construction system inside to build smaller units. It's all very strange, but not unprecedented."
"Right,"
I said thoughtfully. They get energy from methane and raw materials from the ground. This is a highly metallic planet with high-quality ore outcroppings everywhere. I hadn't thought about it before, but this world is a paradise for a machine race.
It might be more sophisticated than that, Kiwi said. They could be predatory machines that consume the less sophisticated types that graze on ore directly.
I nodded. A food chain. The techs will love this place. The thing they were hauling up out of the ground was finally in the open. The little caterpillar guys swarmed all over it. We watched in growing concern.
That metal they're chewing on, that's fresh and straight, I said. I think it's manufactured.
Yes. Don't you recognize it, James?
Kiwi asked.
Can you give me a hint?
That's a dragon leg. You see the claw-like foot? It's been torn loose.
Staring at it, I knew right off she was correct.
You'll make a fine tech someday, Kiwi.
Let's get back to the others and report this. We retreated from the hilltop, backing down the way we'd come. We had time to stand up on our hind legs, but that was about it. There were machines behind us. They'd moved between us and our dragon-driving squad mates. Seeing just one of these critters at a time from the inside of a dragon cockpit, they hadn't looked all that threatening. But standing out here in the open, wearing nothing but smart cloth skivvies, I felt seriously exposed. The machines had all manner of pincers and scoops around their front sections, which seemed to operate like an intake or mouth. They stared at us with their whining little cameras, while their mouth pincers worked the air hungrily.
I see them, vet, Sargon said in my earpiece. We're ready to charge in and take them out. Just give the word.
No, no, I said over my helmet radio. Just sit tight. Graves didn't want us to hurt them.
That's crazy. They're just machines.
You have your order, specialist, I told Sargon. If I die, you can take command and do whatever you want.
This radio conversation seemed to make the machines nervous. I was sure they could hear it, but probably didn't understand it. Maybe it sounded like shouting or like a foreign language to them. I put my hands up and stepped toward the group. There were seven machine creatures all lined up. Two of them were humped up, resting their foreclaws nervously on the backs of the others.
They look like a nervous pack of animals, Kiwi said, using her voice rather than her radio.
Yeah, I said. Well, I'm feeling a little nervous, too.
I walked slowly toward them and squatted. This caused a response. The machines rushed closer. Automatically, I stood up again.
Whoa! Whoa!
I told the excited little robots. When I stood up, they stopped approaching and went back to squirming on top of one another again.
I'm getting the feeling these guys are young, Kiwi said. Young and not too bright. They're responding to your physical posture. Some animals are like that. If you stand up, they think you're bigger. If you get down and small, they figure you're food.
Good observation, I said. I'll make a point of standing tall. Can you fetch me a stick or something?
There weren't any sticks, of course, as there were no plants on this planet, at least not ones we'd found yet. She came up and gave me something that looked like a length of steel tubing about a meter long.
There's trash like this all around their village, Kiwi said. For all we know, it's a bone to them.
Yeah, I hope they don't take offense.
Using my metal stick, I drew a circle in the frosty mud at my feet. Then I backed away from it. The largest of the creatures scuttled forward to examine the circle with his cameras. After about 30 seconds, he used a stubby leg to draw another circle inside the one I'd drawn. His was better than mine, more uniform.
And that's what we call communication, I said.
The machines looked at us expectantly. They rustled and churned their feet. Cameras craned to look at the circle, then at me.
I think they want you to draw something else.
Yeah, just like a pack of bored kids.
I proceeded to draw all kinds of geometric shapes. Each time, the robots imitated me. At last, my helmet buzzed.
McGill, what are you doing out there?
Leeson asked me.
You were supposed to report in and return to base half an hour ago.
Sorry, adjunct, I said. I've made contact with the aliens, and they can't seem to get enough of me.
That's just grand. Figure out a way to pat them on the head and leave. It's getting dark soon, and I want every dragon inspected and recharged for morning.
As I'd hesitated for a long time, the lead machine took the initiative. He, I'd started thinking of him as a he without being sure why, drew something new. Instead of a simple geometric shape, he drew a circle on top of an oval with four longer ovals dangling from the central one.
Ah, Keevy said. You see that? He's drawn a picture of you, James.
I examined the drawing and laughed. So he has. You're a better artist than I am, robot.
Chapter 15. We got back to camp after dark. Returning late turned out to be a bad move. Trotting our dragons over the icy crust of this planet was hazardous in the foggy light of day. In darkness, it was downright dangerous. Two of us broke through the crust of frozen methane and had to be dragged out with tow cables. The group was weary and irritable by the time we reached camp. When we did finally get back to our unit, I immediately regretted the fact that the expedition had left the relative comfort of the lifter behind. Our new encampment wasn't much to look at without the sheltering roof of the lifter's belly above our heads. Our tents were soft, not much more than smart cloth bubbles. They never stopped whipping and flapping in the winds. The mist got inside no matter how hard we worked to make the tents airtight.
I didn't know a planet could smell this bad, Carlos complained. Fart world, that's what we should call it.
No, I said. They've already got a name, haven't you heard? They're calling it Machine World.
Well, I guess that'll work. It's full of wacky machines. Did you ever figure out who the lucky trooper was who got eaten by your little friends?
No one got eaten. Just the dragon did. It was part of Harris's squad. One of the dragons broke down and they left it. When they came back for it hours later, it was gone.
Scavengers. Jackals. That's what those little bastards are. You were crazy to go right up to them and start a drawing contest. What would you have done if they'd torn off your helmet for a snack and burned your face with acid?
I'm pretty sure I'd have died, I admitted.
But we've made contact. Maybe it will do some good in time. If people who've got more training with this than I do can continue the work, maybe we'll be able to communicate with these machines someday.
I've got a better idea, said Carlos. I've been talking it over with Keevy because I need a tech in order to try it out.
I frowned and stared at him. Carlos often got ideas, but they were rarely good ones. What are you up to? I asked. And why Keevy? She's not a real tech, at least not yet.
Hold on, Carlos said loudly, lifting his hands up in front of his face. Don't take a swing at me. I know you and Keevy are doing the nasty again, but that's no reason to...
I almost hit him. I controlled myself with difficulty.
Listen, quit screwing around and tell me your plan. That's an order.
Okay, okay. Here it is. We'll build a little box, see? Just like the one you built with Claver back on Tech World.
A box? What kind of box?
A comm box, retard. Oh, sorry, I mean vet.
When dealing with Carlos, a man had to have a thick skin. There just wasn't any other way to get through a conversation.
Keep talking, I said through gritted teeth.
Carlos seemed honestly surprised I hadn't hit him yet. I was a little surprised, too. But I wanted to hear what kind of cockamamie plan he'd hatched.
Okay, here's the deal, he said. These are machines, right? They have to communicate with codes and protocols of some kind. That means we might be able to hack them. To take them over. Wouldn't that be cool? What if you could just give this army of robots a command and have them all obey you?
What kind of orders?
You know, stuff like kill that squid or rip off Keevy's suit.
I nodded thoughtfully. It wasn't as insane as it sounded. But I knew it wouldn't be easy to do and it might not even be possible. These machines were wild. They weren't slaves like our drones from Earth. They weren't built to take orders and obey them without question.
So why Keevy? I asked. You never said.
Isn't it obvious?
First off, none of the real techs would listen to me. But she did, and she needs rank as badly as I do. If we did something cool like this, we could be specialists within hours. I'd often told him to go do something useful to prove himself, and I had to admit that this sounded like he was at least trying. It also sounded like Keevy would be doing all the work. As long as it doesn't interfere with your regular duties, I've got no objection. I wondered if I'd live to regret my words.
Cool. Thanks, James.
He left to work on his little scheme. I went to the Dragon Corral and cared for my mount personally. I taught my troops to perform minor repairs on their dragons rather than depend totally on the techs. Out here on a wild planet, your kit wasn't someone else's job, it was your life. In the corral, I met up with Della for the first time since she'd dropped the baby bomb on me up on Cyclops. We'd been placed in different platoons, and I'd been too busy coming up to speed on being a veteran in a brand new cavalry cohort to talk much with her. The truth was, I reflected, I'd been avoiding this moment. "Hi, Della," I said cheerily. She gave me a thin smile and a nod. I'm not the best at reading feminine responses, but to me, she looked a little put out. "Hey," I said, walking up to her and wiping my fingers with a dirty rag. "I hope you didn't take things the wrong way up there on Cyclops. I've been so busy learning how to command a squadron of these dragons, I didn't have much time."
"It's okay, James," she said. "Like I said, I've moved on."
"Yeah, sure. The marriage thing. Who'd you marry, anyway? I hope it wasn't that dickhead named Stott." She smiled at me then, and it was the real thing this time.
"No, not him. It's a man you don't know. A good man."
"Great. Great," I said, turning away to go. I'd left things in an unclear state up on the ship, and I wanted her to know I wasn't mad at her or anything. I felt a little relieved I'd accomplished my mission. It was disturbing that some other guy I'd never met was taking care of my kid, but the whole thing was mind-boggling to me anyway.
"James," she said before I'd gone one step, "don't you want to know more about your child?"
I am curious, but I kind of figured that with you being married and all, I should bow out of the picture, if you know what I mean. That was the wrong thing to say. Her face hardened. She was unhappy all over again. Damn. I knew I was out of my element on this one. Sure, I could write a book on how a man should talk to a girl who'd caught him hanging around with a rival woman, or how to explain to a lover why you might have forgotten to send her a text for a couple of days. But this? I was without clue. Whatever my feelings, I could tell by the look in her eye that the ball was in my court. I took a random stab at serving it back.
"Why don't you tell me about her?" I asked, brightly. "About Etta, I mean."
That broke the dam. I was treated to about an hour's worth of pictures and video, and even a lock of the girl's hair to wrap around my fingers. I smiled at that last part. "Blonde hair," I mused. "Real gold-colored, like mine used to be when I was young. Flaxen, my grandma used to call it."
"Do you feel better now?"
Della asked, her eyes searching mine. She was trying to look cool. Hell, Della was the ultimate cool as a cucumber woman. But I knew she was gauging my responses carefully. "Yeah," I said, giving her a big grin. "Can I keep some of the hair?"
"Yes, certainly. I'll transfer the pictures and recordings to your tapper, too."
"Great." We touched tappers, and it was all over in a second. I had a full dump of my daughter's pictures and videos on my arm, permanently. Right at the moment, I wasn't sure if that was going to be a good thing for my mental health or not, but I could tell it made Della happy.
"Hey, when did you get a tapper?"
I asked her.
"After you left Happy Valley. We absorbed as much of your technology as we could. We duplicated most of the simple things like your tappers."
I didn't consider tappers to be simple tech, but I nodded. They were complex machines embedded in the flesh of every full-grown human on Earth. They were powered by our bodies and symbiotic with our flesh. The screens even grew hairs sometimes, and you had to pluck them out. "You guys are wizards," I said. I've never been so impressed with a group of humans in my life. Stuck out there on Dust World with squids hunting you every so often, I never could figure out how you managed to build up a technological society under those conditions. Maybe we did send our best and brightest out into space a century back. She was beaming now. I was proud of myself as well. I'd turned a cold shoulder situation into a happy family reunion. That was quite an accomplishment for a rube like me.
Well, she said, we had help.
You mean from the Galactics? Did they contact you after we left?
No, they didn't. They barely pay any attention to our part of space. From what I understand, that's a good thing.
Yeah. I thought about the Galactic I'd shot the other day. It was a very good thing the Empire was looking the other direction on that one. All my bullshit might get me past a Magua, but I'd never manage to pull a fast one like that on the Narbs or the Empire's battle fleet commanders. If not the Empire, who helped you? She gave me an odd, almost shy look.
I'm not supposed to talk about that, James.
Frowning, I shrugged. Okay, but who told you not to talk? You could trust me, you know. I'm in more trouble with the Empire than you could ever hope to be in your lifetime. This cracked her up. I couldn't recall ever having seen her laugh much before, and it was a nice change today.
I believe you, she said. So I will speak of a mutual friend, but no one else must know.
Okay.
Natasha taught me. She taught all of us. She took tappers from the dead, bodies you didn't recycle before you left, and she rebuilt new ones for us. She's quite talented, you know.
She sure is, I said, looking as confused as I felt. But when did she have time to do all that? Della stared at me for a second.
You don't know.
Know what? She winced, put her hand on my arm, and shook her pretty head.
Forget what I said. Erase it from your mind. It doesn't matter.
She walked away then, and I stared after her in bafflement. It took a full 20 seconds for the light bulb to go off in my dim brain. Sometimes I'm pretty slow on the uptake. When I did get it, the bulb was like a flash of lightning in my skull.
Oh, shit,
I whispered, eyes wide. I ran after Della. She ducked me, walking into the tent with her squatties. I chased after her and threw open the flaps. This pissed off everyone inside as it let the stinky air from the outer mechanical bay into the living quarters. Hey, close that! I did. Then I moved to loom over Della. We've got to talk, I said. She was looking away from me, changing her clothes. She'd been in her grease monkey suit, a coverall with nanofiber surfactants that shed any liquid that came in contact with it. She stripped this off and dropped her clothes in a heap on the floor, never even looking at me while she pulled a normal combat suit out of a locker. Dropping one's drawers in a tent full of people wasn't all that unusual in Legion Varus. We had to live pretty close, especially on a planet with an atmosphere that wasn't quite human-flavored. Still, Della always had been less shy than your typical trooper due to her upbringing on a harsh colony world. For just a second, I was distracted. Della's bare butt was as fine as the first day I'd laid eyes on it back on Dust World in an underground hot spring. Possibly, it looked a shade better than it had back then, as the cavern we had made love in had been pretty dark. A big hand laid itself on my forearm, interrupting my staring session. I knew that hand and that firm grip. I'd know them anywhere. I turned to look at the face glowering at me. It was none other than Veteran Harris.
Look, McGill, he said. The lady has made it pretty clear she doesn't want to talk to you. I think you should show a little tact and move the fuck on.
It was an awkward moment. I looked around and realized the whole squad was watching me. I outranked them all except for Harris, but that didn't make this situation any more acceptable. From their point of view, I was harassing a female soldier who was trying to get away from me. I'm sorry, Vet, I said. But Della and I need to talk for a moment. Do you mind? Harris shook his head.
You don't give up, do you? Quit chasing tail in my squad. Get on back to your own squad if you want to pull that shit.
What? No, hold on, Harris. That's not how it is. Della and I have a history. She had my baby back on Dustworld.
Harris did everything but cross his eyes at that statement. I could tell he didn't know what to make of it.
Are you shitting me, boy? You're a real piece of work. You know that.
Yes, sir. Everyone tells me so.
Shaking his head, Harris turned away. The rest of his squad melted as well. He ushered them out of the flapping, imperfect airlock. When they were all gone, he poked his head back in for one last statement.
If she screams or something, I'm putting you down, you hear me?
Loud and clear.
He left then, and Della turned to face me. She had her arms crossed and her clothes on. I was vaguely disappointed, but at least she couldn't get away.
You shouldn't press this, she said, for the sake of our mutual friend.
Natasha? I asked.
Yes.
You know her. Really know her, don't you? She looked troubled.
I should never have said anything.
I already know. From your reaction, I figured it out. Natasha told me back on Dustworld that she might be a copy. I know about that. I won't tell anyone.
Della searched my face.
It's a violation. Hegemony law, galactic law. Nothing a person can do is much worse. There can be only one person with the same DNA sequence running around at one time. Natasha made that very clear to us.
I wasn't sure about it being the worst violation a person could perform, having committed a number of acts I would consider to be significantly worse. But I smiled reassuringly.
I won't tell. Your secret is good with me.
All right, then.
We eyed one another for a few seconds.
So, I said in a whisper, she got off the doomed Corvus somehow and survived. I could hardly believe she made it across all that empty space to Dustworld. Was she injured?
Yes. Radiation burns. Exhaustion. Only 3 of the techs returned to Dustworld about a month after you left. The other 2 died within weeks. But Natasha hung on.
How did they do it?
I don't understand it all, Della said. I know they managed to rig up some kind of life pod and used a slingshot effect around our star to reach planetary orbit. They finally made re-entry a month after Corvus crashed into the star. Natasha was thin and sick, but we nursed her back to health.
Thinking it over, I could believe it. If anyone could figure out a solution to an impossible physics problem, it was Natasha.
I should have known she'd make it. I told her, the copied version of her, that is, that there was no way it could happen. I didn't want her to worry about it. We owe her so much, James. She taught us the tech that we didn't grasp. We had tech samples from the Empire and the cephalopods. There were piles of forgotten debris all over the valley. She put it all together for us.
I nodded thoughtfully. Natasha was flat out the best tech I'd ever met. It made total sense to me that she'd be up to such a Herculean task.
She taught you, and you came up with trade goods. Nanites, dragons, trade and viability.
I'm sure you do owe her a lot.
Your legion abandoned us. They left us to die, really. You're right. We owe her so much. She knew she could never go home to Earth again. She did her best to make Dustworld livable.
One new colonist, I mused. Just the kind you needed to get your world going. Did she hide when the ships finally came from Earth to trade?
She didn't have to. By then, she'd blended in with the rest of us. No one would ever have guessed who she really was.
Della's explanation was followed by an awkward silence, and I was the one who broke it.
Okay, I said, forcing a tight smile. Now I know everything. I'll be going now.
She stopped me with a hand.
There's one more thing, James. She never stops talking about you.
She's in love with you. I can't figure that out myself.
I chuckled. Love, hate. They're just two sides of the same coin with James McGill.
Chapter 16. Before dawn, I woke up with a hand pawing at me. I slapped it, but it kept coming back. Opening my eyes, I saw Carlos grinning down into my face. Now, I don't know about you, but a hairy, round-cheeked male face was about the last thing I liked to see in the morning.
What the hell do you want? I demanded.
What time is it?
It's explaining time for you, you big freak.
Growling, I came up off my bunk and landed on my feet. Carlos had pushed our friendship too far. I'd advanced in rank, and he hadn't. But he still thought he could treat me like that first day we met at the mustering hall in Newark.
"Whoa, fella," he said, pointing toward the tent flaps.
They parted to reveal Leeson. "About time you got off your ass, McGill. Mind you, I think we should just blast this thing and not even bother having you try to talk to it, but that's not my call to make."
"What?"
I asked. "Haven't you heard that alien-looking mechanical bug thing you made love to out on the ice is outside, trying to communicate? Now get out there and figure out what it wants, pronto."
"Yes, sir."
I scrambled into a vac suit and marched out through multiple fabric airlocks. The pumps wheezed and complained because I hadn't waited around long enough to let them seal up properly and scrub the air that got into our innermost quarters. Gas monitors beeped and farted neutralizing agents to counter the contamination. Outside, it was dawn, or what passed for dawn, on this frozen rock. In practice, that meant the mist wasn't moving around as much as usual, and the diffused light was deep gray rather than the white of day or the black of night. Hanging wisps of vapor swirled around one of the smaller machines, which whirred and clacked. In the still, windless air, the gyrations of the machine appeared to be more pronounced. Its flailing limbs churned, digging at a patch of exposed dirt. I peered at the alien machine. The thing did resemble the one I'd tried to make contact with the day before, but it was hard to be certain. They really did all look alike. The camera eyes noticed me, and they shivered a little. The machine stopped whatever it was doing and looked me over. Finally, it broke off excitedly and ran toward me, gesturing with mouth parts. Running around like a dog, it tried to lead me to the spot where it had been working. I followed it to the flat area where it had been screwing around in the dirt. Squinting, I looked at what it had done.
"Pictures," I said.
"Sketches. You came back for more communication, didn't you?" The robot quivered and did a little spin around its latest work, but interposed itself between me and the other drawings. I figured it wanted me to see this image first. It was a picture of a man, sort of. Only the man looked like an oval with angled sticks for arms and legs. The man was inside a tent like the one I'd just exited. The tent was a bag-like affair encircling it.
"Okay," I said. "Me in a tent. Or at least close enough. What else have you got?"
It backed away and showed me the next thing. This showed a series of blobs surrounding the man in the tent. I didn't get that one.
A bunch of somethings around the tent, okay.
The machine backed up further, showing me the last image. I frowned. I saw the man in the tent was lying flat, and the tent was deflated. It looked like a limp bag on the ground. The circles that had been encircling it were now piled on, drawn on top of the man, the tent, everything.
"Is this some kind of threat?" I asked.
"Or a warning?" Staring cameras regarded me. The artificial feet tapped at random intervals, making clacking sounds on the stones. It had no idea what I was saying. I heaved a sigh, got out my sidearm, and used it to scratch in the dirt beside the images the machine had treated me to.
I drew two figures. One was the man figure, similar in nature to the version the machine had drawn. The other was a machine, one that resembled the little guy I was trying to talk to. I had each extend a stick-like limb toward one another. "So this is what passes for flirtation on machine world, huh, McGill?" Leeson asked. He'd been watching me with mild interest. "Why don't you draw two machines screwing? That will get you there faster." He guffawed with laughter. "I'm trying to make it look like they're shaking hands, not having relations, sir," I told Leeson. I offered him my sidearm. "Maybe you could do better." "Don't put that gun in my hand. I'd as soon shoot this mechanical bug as look at it." While I talked to Leeson, the machine examined my image, then moved to a fresh spot and began to work again. It left behind an image that was similar to mine, but the man figure was all wrong. It had too many limbs, and they looked all curly. Sighing, I tried but couldn't come up with a translation for the machine's work. Maybe it was too early in the morning. Leeson had no answers either. He finally got bored and left. While I continued to examine the latest image the machine had drawn for me, a familiar specialist approached. "Hey," I said in surprise. "What's up, Natasha? I thought you were still aboard Minotaur."
"We're all in the process of coming down now," she said. "Turov has been deploying most of the troops at the beachhead Winslet established south of here, but I was sent here."
I could have asked what beachhead, or made other rude remarks about Winslet, but I didn't. I was too happy to see Natasha. I ushered her to the machine and showed her the drawings. She eyed them with great interest.
"Okay," she said. "I'm pretty sure that's you in the tent in the first image, or at least a generic human."
"Right."
"Then the man in the tent is surrounded and finally destroyed. But what are those blobs that are performing the destruction?"
"I think they're the big machines. They look like conical piles of dirt. That's what the bigger ones look like." She frowned at me.
"So this guy's trying to tell us we're going to be under attack soon?"
"Maybe," I admitted.
"And you drew this last one, the one with the human making out with the other machine?"
"We're shaking hands, damn it."
"Okay, okay. Then your friend drew something else."
"Oh." "What?" I asked. "I didn't get that one."
"Don't you see, James? That's a machine shaking hands with a cephalopod."
The moment she said it, I could see the sketch her way. It was as clear as day now that I thought about it. "He's telling me the machines aren't our friends," I said. "They're allied with the squids."
"Yes," she said. "We must report this to Graves."
I looked around a few minutes later and noticed the machine I'd been struggling to communicate with had wandered off. Reflecting on the entire episode, I wasn't sure if the alien had come here to warn us, to inform us, or just to gloat. The next day went badly. We were out scouting the local region at dawn in preparation for proceeding with our mission. There was no way we could have known what we were in for. The first hint came when my helmet began to scratch with radio signals. I realized I'd left a channel open, a low-frequency channel, in the kilocycle range. I contacted Kiwi first, who messed with her settings and confirmed it. I had her move off a few hundred meters from me to get a second directional reading. The signals pointed out to the lake, north of us. I contacted Graves without hesitation.
"Sir, we have machine readings, lots of them. They seem to be moving nearby. Triangulating with my team, I figure they're north, moving up onto the lake shore."
"Machines?" he asked. "Like the ones in that village you found the other day?"
"Yes, exactly."
"I've reviewed the vids. The machines seemed pretty harmless. Even that big one shuffled off after you left the vicinity of the village. Just don't antagonize them."
"Right, sir, but if I might add, there seems to be a lot of them, and they're coming toward your position from the north."
"Okay, okay. Go up there and scout them for me. Give me a count and a definite heading."
My heart sank. I'd been hoping I'd be recalled, but that wasn't Graves' style. Whether risking his own life or the lives of his troopers, he'd always been a pretty generous contributor to the Reaper. "Okay, saddle up," I ordered. "We're going north to check out that contact." We moved toward the lake shore warily, trotting at about half speed. The mists precluded a full-speed approach, since we might have run into the target's blind. As it turned out, it hardly made any difference. We were less than a kilometer from the mass of them when we realized what we were trotting our long-legged dragons into.
"Machines, Vet! Hundreds of them!"
It was Carlos who sounded the alarm. Normally, I would have been suspicious of a line like that coming from him, but the tone in his voice indicated he was serious.
"Check them out. Have they detected you?"
"They're big ones, Vet. Like the Mama machine we saw back at the village. They're coming my way. I think they can hear our radios."
"Right. Wheel your mounts and ride,"
I ordered my squad. All around me, dragons turned and ran back the way we'd come. It wasn't our job to fight these machines. We were supposed to locate them and gather intel. That was it.
"Carlos, can you give me a count?"
"I don't know. I see at least four on my tail. Geez, these things are big. They're fast, too. One of them is gaining on me. It just won't give up."
I reported into Graves, then noticed Carlos's blinking light. He was trying to contact me.
"Carlos, what's happening?"
"One of them caught me," he said, breathing hard. "It just plowed me over and knocked my mount down. But I'm still breathing. It hasn't breached the capsule yet. Permission to fire, Vet."
I was surprised he'd bothered to ask. I wouldn't have.
"Permission granted. Defend yourself. We're coming back."
"Is that a good idea?"
Keevy asked.
"We're not supposed to antagonize the locals. You were drawing pictures in the dirt with them yesterday."
"Yeah, yeah," I said. "That was before they attacked one of us. I told Graves I'd leave them alone unless they attacked first."
"That's right," Sargon said. "We've got clear rules of engagement. The locals have broken them. Maybe they'll respect us more if we show them we aren't helpless."
We plunged through the white mists and topped a small rise in the land. A machine loomed into view on the far side. It had to be the one that was trying to eat Carlos. This machine was big. It was hard to judge, but I'd be willing to bet it was even bigger than the first Mama machine we'd met up with. The configuration was familiar. A mountain of interlocking plates covering a body that looked like a giant metal slug. Flashes of light erupted from under the machine as we approached. I figured that was probably Carlos trying to give it indigestion. I looked around but didn't see any other machines. If I had to guess, I figured they'd moved off while the lucky one that had caught Carlos tried to have a meal.
"Spread out. When I give the order, fire your grenades high," I said. "We don't want to blast our own man."
The squad went into action. Without being told, Sargon led his group around to the machine's flank. The machine seemed to take notice of us, shivering and twisting this way and that, as if nervous. But it didn't want to leave its kill. I could tell we were going to have to give it some encouragement.
"Fire at will!"
Everyone began raining grenades down on the machine. They popped and flashed, but didn't penetrate. A few of its scales fell off, but not enough. I knew what the problem was. Our weaponry was built to take out infantry, not heavily armored targets.
"Carlos!" I called. "Can you still hear me?"
He didn't answer, and that's when I noticed his squad ID was red. His name, on the list of names in my cockpit, was listed as a dead link. I didn't know if he'd succumbed or his radio had gone out. The effect was pretty much the same either way. We had to get past this thing's armor before it ate him entirely.
"I'm going in close," I shouted. "Hold the grenade fire until I punch a hole in those outer plates."
I galloped forward, running my dragon at full speed. At the last second, the shivering alien machine lifted its lower edge. I realized that's how it must engulf things. It looked like I was about to run right under its skirt and spend some quality time with Carlos's corpse.
"Look out, McGill!" shouted Keevy.
Without taking the time to answer her, I engaged my dragon's exoskeletal legs with full power, stiffening the metal springs in the feet. I bounded high when I reached the machine, sailing right over the uplifted lip of it and landing with a sprawling clatter on top. The footing was uneven at best. I didn't have more than a second or two before I knew it would reshape itself and send me crashing back down to the ground. After that, I knew it would swallow me. Stabbing at the controls, I let my grippers fold back. Twin high-powered force blades sprang from my dragon's arms.
Up close, the machine was more complex and bizarre than I'd realized previously. It had cameras, lots of them, like a spider with eyes clustered between its